people wanted to sue a Jew in a secular court, and I participated in it, came to me with an annotated page of the Choshen Mishpat explaining why. And that was the case of the library of the former Lubavitcher Rebbe. I still remember this was a library that was collected by the father-in-law of the last Lubavitcher Rebbe. And it was taken from him or kept in Europe at the time that he came over to the United States, and he made efforts to bring it over to the United States. And finally it came to the United States after the war and was kept at 770 Eastern Parkway at Lubavitch headquarters. And it was under lock and key there. A library of immense value, had original manuscripts, had old volumes, incunabula, all kinds of books. And suddenly, volumes from that library began appearing on the markets, Judaica markets in Switzerland and in Israel. And the Lubavitch representatives, the leaders of the community, and the Rebbe himself were puzzled on how that could happen. They installed a secret TV camera at the entrance to that library, and I remember receiving a call at 1 in the morning and being asked what they should do now that they apprehended on the film the nephew of the Rebbe, the son of his sister-in-law and brother-in-law, Barry Gerari, taking books out of that library, opening the door with a key, taking books out of the library, removing them, what they can do. And they came down to my office with a page from the Choshen Mishpat that said that if you cannot get relief from a rabbinic court, from a Beis Din, then you're permitted for that limited purpose to go to a secular court. He had really made up a list of more than 400 books that he had taken from the library that he was offering on the markets in Switzerland and in Israel. And the question was, how are we going to keep those books from being sold while we were trying to get them back? And the answer was to go to court, to a secular court, to get a temporary restraining order, which is what we did. We filed a request for a temporary restraining order in a federal court directed at keeping those books under court order while there could be a din Torah over it. And I remember we filed the complaint, and the day we filed it, we were assigned a non-Jewish judge by the name of Charles Sifton, who happened to be on vacation at the day that we filed the complaint. But we needed immediate relief. So we ended up being sent to the chambers of a Jewish judge in Brooklyn by the name of Leo Glasser. I remember walking into his chambers and noticing on the wall of his chambers was a front page from a Rambam printed in the 16th century in a frame on the wall of his chambers. And we sat around the table there, and he looked at the complaint and he said, "Look, this case belongs in a rabbinic court." And I said, "Absolutely. We agree. We ought to go to a rabbinic court once we get an order that will keep him from selling the books in the meantime." And my adversary, who was representing the defendant in the case, said, "Oh no, we want this entire case and the ownership of the entire library decided by a secular court, decided by this court." The bottom line was that the judge entered a temporary restraining order, the books were put under lock and key, and there was a full trial, which is a story in itself, over the ownership of that library. It was, I can tell you, the best attended trial that I have ever been involved in. Not only was it the best attended, every seat in the spectator section was filled for every session of that proceeding. Buses were coming in. People were drawing lots in Crown Heights as to who it is who was going to be privileged to sit there during the trial and listen to this case. Not only the best attended trial, but I was the best fed lawyer, I'm sure, throughout the United States, because my clients brought in this terrific lunch every day. Fortunately, the federal judge in the neighboring courtroom was semi-retired, never showed up, so we commandeered his courtroom, and every day, marvelous lunch would be set up during the lunch break in this neighboring courtroom. We would daven mincha, we'd have lunch, and then in the afternoon we'd resume the court proceeding in the afternoon. But that was a case that was instituted only on the basis of the very specific exception to the rule regarding not going to our coast, not going to a secular court, except when a Beis Din cannot give you the relief that you need in the interim. Why is it Chayorah? Assuming then that this reference in Pirkei Avos, when it's talking about Chilul Hashem, is talking about the Chilul Hashem that results from bringing your case, your claim against another Jew, against a rabbinic court, against rabbis. There are suits against rabbis for defamation. I mean, rabbis have got to go and take out liability insurance these days for these kinds of claims that are being made against them. It's a whole new wave of litigation. Why is it Chayorah? I think that the answer is that a Chayorah, an animal, a beast, turns on everybody. Turns even on the person who brings it in, who thinks he has tamed. The number of stories one reads of lion tamers who think they're safe and know they're lions and still get clawed and mauled and sometimes even killed. The Chayorah, once you loose that Chayorah, devours everybody in sight. The people who go with Shvu Hashav and with Chilul Hashem to the secular courts are letting loose a Chayorah, something that's going to turn on them, that's totally uncontrollable. It's unlike the other forms of punishment and death because it turns on the very person who brings it in. And the fact is that in these cases, the case that I'm in now in New York, the deposition testimony is turning totally against the plaintiff. She claimed, Shvu Hashav, she claimed in her complaint that what was written about her was total lies. The depositions are proving that they're entirely true. She claims that the rabbis were bribed. The depositions are totally disproving it. They're proving only that what was done was right. But this is a case that is an enormous Chilul Hashem. Should never have been in a court of law. And that is, I submit to you, the explanation for the second reference in Pirkei Avos to Chilul Hashem. That it is that kind of conduct that leads to the very worst consequences. Chilul Hashem is described by Chazal as the kind of Aveira for which there is no kapara. It's the most extreme form of offense, except Misa itself. There's no kapara for Chilul Hashem. And lesson that we have to draw from these cases, from the instances where either people's conduct baseser, the conduct of others that reflects on the entire Jewish community, and the conduct that unleashes forces that you can't control, and that will consume the person who brings them in, those are the evils of Colossians.
Sure. Okay, thank you very much. We will take questions. We do have a microphone, which I'll move in the center of the aisle. And so whoever has questions, if you want to line up, we'll take 3-4 at a time, and then Mr. Lewin can answer the questions.
If I can remember 3-4 at a time at my age. I mean, I'm ready to take them one at a time if you'll ask them.
There were some cases in the United States over a number of years regarding mechitzas and shuls and the attempts by some boards of some shuls to remove mechitzas. I believe that one of the people was involved, if I'm not mistaken, Baruch Litvin. Now, do you have any comment on people who were trying to prevent those mechitzas being removed, having to go to the civil court in order to achieve that goal?
It's again, those it's interesting that you ask that question, because it certainly, again, like other things, brings to mind things that are 40 years old. The Mechitza case in Mount Clemens that you've talked about, which is the case that Baruch Litvin was involved in, was a case which caused a lot of comment within the Jewish community when it was decided in 1960, as a matter of fact. I was then a member of the Harvard Law Review, and among my classmates who were members of the Harvard Law Review was a current Supreme Court Justice, Antonin Scalia, Nino Scalia, who is, as a matter of fact, a good friend. He's been a guest of mine at my sukkah. He's a devout Catholic. Very, very conservative, has issued some decisions that I strongly, strongly disagree with, including one in which he really read the freedom of religion clause out of the First Amendment, which appalled me, given the fact that he's as devout a Catholic as he is. But when that case was decided, I will tell you that various people called me. I was then a student at the Harvard Law School, but they knew I was on the Harvard Law Review, and they said, look, it would be very useful if the Harvard Law Review did a note in its one of its issues while you were there on the editorial board, chose to publicize this case. I thought that was a terrific idea. So I put it forward in terms of the editorial board. They said, okay. And they assigned somebody to write a note. Well, somebody wrote a note which was scathingly critical of the decision of the Michigan Supreme Court that had said that you may not remove the machitza. And Nino Scalia, who was then the notes editor of the Harvard Law Review, was ready to send it into print. And we had arguments, I mean, Scalia and I, so much so that it is still... Just within the last month, I met somebody who was on the Law Review that year with us, and he says he remembers that there was some note that was written that I killed after Scalia had worked on it and written it and all this other, because it ended up, we had this enormous difference, and finally they decided not to publish the note because it would have been very, very critical of the decision of the Michigan Supreme Court, and I was arguing against it and he was arguing for it. The truth is, that whole area, when you ask me about that, yes, I think that is an exception from the rule that you don't go to our coast. There are questions of religious law and protection of religious liberties, it seems to me, where you have no choice. The other side is not going to listen to a Beis Din. If they're removing a machitza, you're not going to get a Beis Din that they will agree on that will resolve that question. I've had battles over Eruvin, as Naftali mentioned in his introduction with me, where it's Jews generally who fight against the Eruv. They don't want to see an Orthodox community develop, and therefore they use the Eruv as a pretext, and they say it's unconstitutional to have an Eruv. I still remember one of those cases, Bell Harbor, New York, where we defended an Eruv. We did it successfully in the trial court, and then the other side appealed to the New York appellate court. Five judges sitting up there. The other side were basically Reformed Jews who did not want to see these Orthodox Jews come into Bell Harbor. And they were opposed to the Eruv. And they had a Jewish lawyer who stood up there. And he argued against the Eruv. And he stood up before these five judges and said, "This Eruv," he says, "it's, you know," he told a story. At that point, I think somebody had been decapitated in Israel who rode a motorcycle into a wire Eruv in Bnei Brak or someplace, and he told that story. And then he said, "This Eruv, besides being dangerous," I mean, it was ridiculous. It was in Bell Harbor, it was made up of seawalls and, you know, high. But anyway, besides being dangerous, he says, "These folks who are just trying to keep everything closed on Saturday, these folks are trying to tell you that the reason they want this Eruv is so that the children can come to the temple and that the women can wheel their strollers with the children to the temple. They don't want to see the women in the temple. When the women come to the temple, they lock them up upstairs or off in some other room because they don't want to see them there." And he launched into this whole thing. Well, I got up and I had to defend this thing. So first I tried very calmly to defend the constitutionality of it. And then I said, before I sat down, "Look, there are a couple of things that have been said here that are so offensive, I can't sit down without responding to some of those terribly offensive things that were said." And off on the left, I still recall it, was a woman judge whose name I now forget. And she interrupted me and she said, "Mr. Lewin, I agree with you. What your adversary said was really offensive." And I thought, "Ah, marvelous." And she said, "It was so offensive. He was talking about those women wheeling the strollers to the temple. Why can't men wheel strollers to the temple?" All right.
Is there a difference between a diaspora court and Eretz Israel secular court of law?
Good question. As a matter of fact, I have prepared here, but it would have gone past my 30 minutes, my red light time here, a tshuva from Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, who dealt exactly with that question. And the question was, what about Israeli judges? And at least his answer to it was that the Israeli judges are no different than anyone else, that they do not make up an appropriate Beis Din, and the fact that they may occasionally rely on what they think to be Jewish law does not convert it into the Beis Din that you have to go to. Now, I can't say there's a unanimity of view about that. There were some, and Rav Waldenberg's tshuva also quotes, I think, from Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who responded to a lawyer who, after the creation of the state, had written to Rav Frank, who was then the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, and certainly a very, very distinguished authority, arguing that an Israeli court is different because a Dina can apply to Israel, and because these are Jewish judges, and they, you know, you can assume that they can try to apply things that are Torah law. And Rav Frank rejected that, and Rav Waldenberg quoted that thing. So there is substantial authority that Israeli judges are no different than American judges, and there are American judges. I mean, the truth is, my adversary in the Lubavitch Books case is now a federal judge in New York, in the trial court in New York. He's written a couple of opinions, I think, which quote Jewish law. He's interested in Jewish law. He's written a couple. There are some others. A judge in the Eighth Circuit in the United States was a Jewish judge who questions is written to people who he thinks will be able to give him some insight in terms of Jewish law. I myself recently wrote a brief, which I think was a first in the Supreme Court of the United States, on the question of the constitutionality of the use of electrocution as a means of capital punishment. And I thought it would be useful for the Supreme Court of the United States to see what was an authentically, totally Jewish view of it. It's the first brief, I think, ever filed in the Supreme Court, which quoted not a single secular source, based entirely on quotes from the Gemara, from Rambam, from other things which we filed in the Supreme Court of the United States on behalf of the National Jewish Commission on Law and Public Affairs, and various Jewish groups, the International Association of Jewish Lawyers and Jurists. So I think all these things are interesting, but they don't convert a secular court into a bezdin.
I was wondering about when a Jewish woman goes to Beis Din, sometimes they don't feel that they get a fair hearing because mostly they're all men, and it's a woman goes against all these men. And if a person does a lawsuit against someone else, and it just goes between the insurance company and the lawyer, and it doesn't get to court. What's your opinion on that?
Okay, I didn't quite get the second part of your question. Let me deal with the first part first, because I think it's an interesting and worthwhile inquiry, really. I think more and more, quite frankly, the Bote Din are indicating, you know, very substantial receptivity to women's claims. I mean, after all, one thing you have to realize is that so much of traditional tshuvas were devoted to question of agunot. In different circumstances, maybe not in the circumstance that we have today of men who don't, you know, who get a civil divorce and don't want to give a get, but nonetheless, the question of being mater and aguna is a major subject in terms of Jewish response. It is not something that's been ignored over the centuries. And the truth is that a lot of the rabbinic, the Bote Din, look for ways today to be sure to be fair to women within the halachic context in the circumstances of a divorce situation. In addition to which, there is a growing movement in Israel, maybe not among the most extreme right wing yet, but among some of the sort of centrist dayanim, to recognize toanot, women lawyers in rabbinic courts. It's a developing practice in matrimonial disputes before Bote Din to have women who are trained and who are toanot, who make the arguments to the Beis Din on behalf of women and on behalf of men. The interesting thing is that these toanot sometimes represent men in these cases. So it's no longer fair, I think, to assume that every rabbinic court is hostile to women. And I have to say that although the politically correct thing today in the public mind is always to take the side of the woman in the matrimonial disputes, and I can tell you, part of the introduction was the fact that I drafted the New York Get Law in 1982. The Aguda was in the forefront of trying to work something out so that there could be a provision under New York law that would require that a get be given. And I have worked towards that end in the 1982 Get Law and in other things that I've done since then. However, I have seen, as I've seen in law practice generally, that the truth is not always with the woman in the dispute. And in this case that I'm involved with up in New York now, where the suit was against the Beis Din, her claim is simply wrong. The woman who is trying to sue the rabbis for defamation in another suit is simply wrong. And yet the media are not always ready to accept that. There's still a bias in the media of assuming that every woman's claim is right. Not true.
Because there was a case, and you just brought up a point, there was just a case in Detroit recently, around Tisha B'Av time, where there's a woman, Jewish woman, wanted to open a kosher meat market. And what happened was, she wasn't from, so the Rad Rabbanan wouldn't allow her to open it. And what happened was, not Erev Tisha B'Av, but the day, you know, the next day. And what happened, she went on the news media and told them, you know, about these rabbis, the Rad Rabbanan wouldn't let her open it up and all that. Anyways, you try to get the rabbis' comment, you know, their opinion. And all the rabbis weren't working that day. It was Tisha B'Av. They were all home praying, they said. But it's just, you know, a thing that somebody goes to the news media. Now, one thing about the question which I mentioned, you know, the last question, about if a person takes a Jew to start a lawsuit against a Jew, well, but the lawyers deal with the insurance company back and forth, but it doesn't actually get to court. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, if it's not something that's done publicly in court, but there is a claim that's resolved between the insurance companies, I don't think that that's necessarily a problem, although I suppose that can be done even if it's brought before a Beis Din in some way. I mean, if the other side is ready to be bound by the decision of a Beis Din, then the question is getting the insurance company to agree that that's a form of arbitration and therefore liability might follow and therefore they ought to settle the case. So either way, but it's not, it may not involve the same Chilul Hashem as going through a whole public proceeding in a court.
So would you like to comment on what your experiences have been with Batei Dinim, and specifically if you think there's a perception in the Jewish marketplace that Batei Dinim are not rendering fair and equitable decisions? Also, if you can comment on specifically lawyers taking cases in which they know their clients they're aware of certain improprieties that their clients have done, but yet undertake the cases and argue and put in all kinds of roadblocks to obstruct justice in any way they can.
Okay, well, let me deal first with the second question. It's one that I frequently get as a lawyer who handles sort of white-collar criminal defense cases. How can you represent so-and-such if he's so plainly guilty? First of all, I have to tell you, with the exception of very few clients who have said to me at the outset, look, I'm guilty, get me the best possible deal, most of my clients don't say they're guilty. And as much as I may try, I don't know. The thing about white-collar criminal defense is that there are shades of gray. To the public, you know, things are absolutely black and white. Somebody's guilty or is not guilty. There's frequently a lot to be said, even for somebody who has been either close to the line or over the line. And the system is such that you deal with prosecutors. Generally, what I try to do, first of all, a reputable lawyer doesn't lie to even to prosecutors. I don't lie to them. I don't lie to juries. If a case goes to trial and I advise a client, and I can't recall a case where I have taken it to trial where I have thought that the client is guilty and I'm just simply trying to get him off or trying to obstruct justice in some way. But part of the system is that the prosecutor does what he can in this country to get the most drastic sentence against the defendant, and you do what you can as a defense lawyer to ameliorate that. I don't feel badly when my client is treated more humanely by the system than what may be prescribed. I mean, I recently had a case, a very unfortunate case, of a fellow who had a substantial government job, was well respected in his community, was a member of the Orthodox congregation in the Washington area, and it turned out was engaging from his home on his home computer on the internet in child pornography, and had the terribly bad fortune to be communicating with an FBI undercover agent who was masquerading as a 14-year-old girl. And he ended up being arrested. And he admitted he was guilty. I represented him. I did the best I could to get his sentence reduced as much as possible. It was extraordinary that under the sentencing guidelines in the United States, this man, although he had a wife who stood by him and children and grandchildren and was suffering terrifically, could be sentenced to close to 5 years in jail for having done this. And after long presentations before a district judge, who was known as a tough sentencer in Maryland, she ended up giving him several months in jail and then home detention for about a year. And I thought this was a terrific victory, and really I thought it was a good result. And the next thing I knew, the government, whose job it is to get the most severe sentence, appeals that, which they can now do in the United States, to the Court of Appeals. So a couple of weeks ago, I was in Richmond, Virginia, defending the decision of this judge to give what I thought was a humane sentence to this individual. Now, he was guilty. He admitted he was guilty. We didn't do anything to obstruct justice. I think it was right for him to be defended. I think it was right for him to be defended aggressively, so that we could get the best possible result for him. That's the way the system works. I don't view that as being in any way unethical or improper. Now, your question, your other question, is about the perception of Batei Din. There's no question. It's a problem. There are Batei Din and there are Batei Din. There are Rabbanim and there are Rabbanim. There are, as you know, in any society, you have better and worse, and you have those that have unfortunately not done what they should do as members of a Beis Din. But the truth of the matter is, those few cases get enormous amount of attention within the Jewish community. And the people I know who sit on Batei Din sit on them week in and week out. They may do hundreds of cases. There are always litigants who are unhappy. That happens in the court system too. People walk out of trials and they say the judge is unfair, he was biased against me, you know, he's wrong, he's not treating me right. That happens with members of a Beis Din as well. But by and large, I think that the rabbis who sit on Batei Din, on established Batei Din, and even those who sit on Zablas, on, you know, ad hoc Batei Din, which each side picks a rabbi and the two of them pick a third, do a good job. Could they do a better job? Yes. The Rabbinical Council of America, which is a more centrist organization, set up the Beis Din of America, tried to give it as much organization and sort of systematize it as much as possible. They're trying to do what they can. The Agudas HaRabbanim has gotten, I think, a bum rap in this case that I've got in New York. This woman is taking out full-page advertisements. She has spent close to $1 million. She's a very wealthy woman, and she runs long, big ads in the Allgemeine Journal, and for a while was doing it in the Jewish press until they finally turned her off and realized how wrong she was. But, you know, blackening the names of rabbis because of judgments that they make, that's in no way justified. And it's a real chilul Hashem, I think, and a real threat to a system on which the Jewish community has relied for centuries.
Forgive me, Rabbi, if you've already addressed this. To what do you attribute this deterioration in ethical values? To what do you attribute this deterioration in ethical values?
Well, The question was, to what do I attribute the deterioration in ethical values? I think to some extent, maybe it is the fact that the religious community is, in some sense, becoming more commercially successful in the United States. I mean, in this, you know, the generations since the war and all that, we have some remarkably successful people in the business world. That has caused others either to be envious of them, to see, to try to emulate them, maybe to take shortcuts. I think that's part of the answer. I think it's, you know, part of our becoming more comfortable in a certain sense in the world around us. It also has a sort of snowball effect. Once you have one or two or three of these cases that achieve public notoriety, then, quite frankly, I think the prosecutors begin to look much more closely at other firm people. And there is a, no question, a sort of group, a grouping, a characterization, a classification of the community as such. And the minute somebody is involved who is Hasidic, just like these jurors in the case that I was in, you know, all Hasidim are suspect because my sister or my relative had a landlord who was a Hasid and treated her badly. So the prosecutors begin to look at it that way too. Aha, look, there's a fellow who's involved in this business who's got a beard and a black hat. This is suspicious. This guy's probably up to no good. One of the things that disturbed me the most when I heard these accounts was that in the prosecutor's office in Brooklyn, the word ganif became a common term that was being used among the non-Jews in that office. You know, these are ganifs. You know, this is the whole attitude, the whole, you know, the broad brush that is used to sweep at the community. At the same time, I think what the Novominska Rebbe says is certainly true. There are more such instances. There are more cases of people who are shown to have been involved in activity that creates a Chilul Hashem. And it behooves the community, that community itself, to realize and to get the lesson. Some of the federal judges in Brooklyn view this as being the time that they've got to give a lesson to the community. They've been known to say that in court. I'm going to send a lesson to the community by sentencing so and such to some extended period of time. And that's an unfortunate situation.
Mr. Moon, can you comment on the Pollard case?
Okay. Let me tell you, so far as the Pollard case is concerned, I've been limited in terms of any public participation. I am the lawyer of record, and in fact the lawyer for an individual known as Avim Sela. Avi Sela was the Israeli who was in the Israeli embassy in Washington at the time that Pollard was engaged in the activities that led to his conviction. He was the original contact between Sela and various Israelis. And that this is a matter of public record that they met at a social event and then there were discussions between them. Sela has been indicted in the United States and is under indictment and cannot come to the United States because if he came to the United States, he'd be arrested and thrown in jail and prosecuted, presumably. So for that reason, I have not been able to be publicly involved in any way in the Pollard case. I can tell you that, of course, I don't think that my involvement as an attorney has anything to do with the general view of whether the sentence was excessive. I plainly think it was excessive. I think the man should no longer be in jail today. On the other hand, I have to tell you that I think Mr. Pollard is his own worst enemy. And that's, again, looking at it totally from the outside. I will tell you that before I became involved, before his sentencing, the week of Pollard's sentencing, I still recall it, the week that Pollard was going to be sentenced, I think it was on a Friday, I met that week at a social event with a man by the name of Wolf Blitzer, who's now a CNN correspondent, who was then the correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. And Wolf Blitzer had gotten an interview with Jonathan Pollard at his prison. And he had written an article on the Sunday before the sentencing that appeared in the Washington Post Outlook section, front page, in which he said, Jonathan Pollard gave the Israelis information that was vital to Israeli interests, very significant, it should not be undermined or underplayed, it shouldn't be minimized, it was very important information, and went on at some length with that. And I met Blitzer that week. Pollard was going to be sentenced on Friday. I knew about the case from the papers. I was not involved in it. He was being represented by an experienced white-collar Washington criminal defense lawyer named Richard Hybe, who was Lebanese, and who I must say the family did not know was Lebanese when they hired him, but I think he represented him like a white-collar criminal defense lawyer would. And I said to Wolf Blitzer, why did you write this article? That is bound to prejudice the judge. He's going to sentence this man on Friday. I didn't remotely dream he was going to give him a life sentence, but I nonetheless thought it was going to increase the sentence. And Blitzer said to me, and I believe him, and he, I think, has said it since, he says, look, that was the condition under which Pollard agreed to talk to me. Only if I would write what he said about the importance of this information to the Israelis, because Pollard believes that the Israelis will bail him out of this. And therefore, he wants the word to be public that the information he gave the Israelis was very important to them. That was what Wolf Blitzer said to me. A gross miscalculation by Jonathan Pollard. But it's only the first of many in the history of the Pollard case. And as I say, although I have all the sympathy in the world for him, I think he is the victim of injustice, he has not done himself good by what he has done during all these years. He's made enemies of the people who have helped him. There have been people who came to his defense, who volunteered time, only to find that after a couple of years, he was excoriating them for no good reason. They tried to help him, and suddenly they became enemies because what they did didn't succeed.
And on behalf of Ilana and Naftali and the Orthodox Caucus, the Toronto Ethics Project, I want to thank Mr. Lewin for his very inspiring names, even though it's a legal subject which perhaps many people may find a technical aspect. I think from a religious point of view, it's a very inspiring talk. And I want to thank you. It's very interesting in all the cases, and it's a pleasure having you as a guest in our home. And I want to thank you all for coming. And there are refreshments outside. And we will have a Marid Minyan in the Beis Medrash in a few minutes. So thank you very much. Thank you.